This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. Now, if you're going to write a crime thriller, what do you think are the essential ingredients? Well, how about a big helping of murder? Mix in a generous portion of blackmail, spice everything up with a layer of greed, add a dollop or two of 1979 Los Angeles, and sprinkle in a shiny El Camino. Pasadena-based writer Chip Jacobs has perfected the recipe with his latest book, The Darkest Glare. Only, there's one important ingredient Mr. Jacobs has no option but to admit to. His new crime thriller is true. All of it. Although The Darkest Glare reads like a grotesquely macabre fantasy, it also has moments of absurd hilarity. Yet despite this, Chip Jacobs undoubtedly has the ability to create a dark, twisted tale. He readily agrees that even he could not come up with such a bizarre cast of characters or a plot with more twists and turns than a bowl of spaghetti. The always engaging Mr. Jacobs is standing by to talk with me. First, just as we were putting this show together, news came in that the last surviving member of the original Wailers had passed. One Neville O'Reilly Livingston, also known as Bunny Livingston or Bunny Wailer, dead at the age of 73, just a couple of months short of his 74th birthday. Long considered a living legend, the Rastafarian singer-songwriter had won a number of Grammy Awards and was recently named by Newsweek as one of the three most important musicians in the world of music. As a tribute, I'm going to take you back in time to circa 1981 for a 12-inch on Solomnic Records. This is the late Bunny Wailer with Rise and Shine. segued into the massive dub version there. A tribute to the late Bunny Wailer with a 12-inch from 1981, Rise and Shine. Bunny Wailer dead, just a couple of months short of his 74th birthday. Over on Life Elsewhere Music, volume 223, you can hear an even earlier cut from Bunny Livingston, a terrific rock steady sound from 1971, Search for Love. Next up, my conversation about murder, blackmail, greed, and Los Angeles in the late 70s with author Chip Jacobs. The title, The Darkest Glare, a true story of murder, blackmail, and real estate greed in 1979 Los Angeles. The author, Chip Jacobs. Chip, welcome back to Life Elsewhere.
Oh, feels amazing to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. This is my first official interview like this. So, I'm lucky.
Very cool to have you back. It's been quite some time since we last spoke. Yes. And I got to tell you, the last time we chatted, I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. Let's start off with pointing to the cover. When this goes up as a video as well, people could be able to see this clearly if they get the book. There's an El Camino on the cover.
Correct.
And I have to tell you, Chip, after reading this book, I am never going to look at an El Camino the same way again. Plus, I've always had a suspicion that El Caminos were really a kind of a front for skullduggery. El Caminos just had that look about them. So I'm so glad that you chose an El Camino because it plays an important part in your book. But I need to ask you, why did you choose an El Camino?
Yeah, it's a good question. We went round and round on the covers. You know, this is not an easy story to tell about people most folks had never heard of, in seemingly another America. And the El Camino was the talisman, this terrible, evil crime. You know, it's a car that's kind of like a Minotaur. You know, it's half car, half truck, and, has secrets inside. And that's what Howard Garrett, the killer, drove. And he used this car as like a morgue for dead bodies, catnip for criminals. You know, he wanted to lure into his murder for profit corporation. Yeah. And also just to be a badass carpenter who could stare down the scariest person you could think.
Yes.
So, it perfectly represented him.
Okay. So let's get into the book. Going to be totally honest with you. I would say about halfway through the book, Chip, and I stopped and I said to myself, I'm going to call up Mr. Jacobs and I'm going to say to him, okay, Chip Jacobs, be honest with me. This ain't true. You're making this whole thing up.
For many of the people involved, I think they wish that was the case. You know, this story has followed me around like a bad penny. And, that's why I decided to, I've written about this story before, but I decided to write it in a true crime mystery fashion. And one of my biggest obstacles is getting people to realize it's not a novel. This stuff really happened. You know, Jerry Snyderman is sort of the protagonist, the anti-hero. He didn't realize 90% of the dark ecosystem swirling around him. He was just a guy with somebody's foot on his neck. It is true about this hapless group of criminals, about the multiple attempts to take out the first target, cross-dressing, a hitman with conscience who tries to disrupt the scheme, doesn't work. All these famous lawyers in it. You know, I wish somebody would just say, oh my God, Robert Shapiro, a future California Supreme Court justice, and others knew about this murder before it went down.
Yes.
And, you know, somehow or another, the momentum was so great you could not stop it. So, it isn't fabricated.
Having established that, let's just go back a little bit for my listeners who aren't familiar with the story. Let's just give a little overview of the cast. Well, not the whole cast of characters, but the three main characters.
Sure.
And
Just outline the story for us, Chip.
You got it. This takes place in 1978-1979, Los Angeles. It was really a very angry time in America, similar to today. People felt the system that they believed in had given them the shaft. Nonetheless, three individuals grouped together in a hip mansion near Miracle Mile in toward the west side of Los Angeles in what was called space planning, or otherwise known as interior architecture. One was this 27-year-old prodigy named Jerry Snyderman. His partner was a about 12 years older, dashing, debonair, could sell ice to the igloos, salesman named Richard Kasparov. I changed his last name to protect the innocent. And Howard Garrett, who they recruited to come into the firm because they saw a shortcut to riches by adding construction services to their shop. And, you know, he was very different than the cool bell-bottom wearing, pot-smoking, electronic music and Beatles-loving folks in there. He was this kind of vulture-eyed, thick-skinned, El Camino-driving contractor that was, you know, he was the person that didn't fit in. Nonetheless, he saw opportunities. He saw people willing to buy his smoke and bull story about his past. And for a while, they succeeded very well until they didn't.
Yes. Let's talk about the writing style, because I used a quote from your book on a tweet that I sent out a couple of days ago, which for me, it espoused exactly how you've written this book. It's got great descriptions. It's very noirish, yes. And it's fast paced. It's got a lot of intrigue. You keep sort of leaving us in suspense, and then wham, you give us another twist and another turn. It's a fabulous read.
Thank you.
So talk to me about the writing style. It has a, and I mean style in quotes. It's got a very specific style.
I don't think I can write without being descriptive. You know, I come from the world of journalism where a lot of times that's looked down upon, you know, and though there's feature writers that are immensely talented, I don't know how to write any other way. And a writing teacher once told me the best thing you can do is be curious about the world and write visually. And I try to write visually. You know, a lot of true crime, I don't consider myself a true crime writer. I don't know if I have the intestinal fortitude to dig through bloody scenes like that. But, you know, I try to put people in that mansion. I try to put people, you know, in Jerry's office when Howard comes and says the most wicked things to him a human being could say. You know, sometimes true crime can read a little to me, you know, it's all action and no, and little, I don't know, fleshing of human beings.
Yes.
You know, they're so tied to the procedural and elements of it and making sure all sides are heard and court, you know, legal moves made. To me, that's, I don't care as much about that. You know, I'm always interested in the why as opposed to the, you know, the where and when. And so I did try, what's the point of writing about, you know, poor Richard Kasparov if I'm not telling people how he got here, his stakes, his past, and what he looked like, how he spoke, you know?
Yes.
So I don't think I know any other way.
I think that's what keeps it so intriguing, because you're reading and all of a sudden you go, okay, well, Howard is not who we think Howard is. You introduce Howard in a very sort of, it's a very gentle kind of way, the way you bring Howard into the story. And next thing you know, wow, I'm kind of like on the edge of my seat saying, what? But as you're doing it, this is what I think is so important. As you're doing it, you're giving us not only details about how he looks, how he even smells, because there is a description about his body odor at one point, but you're also giving us understanding of how the different characters are feeling at the time. You get inside of them and you talk to us through them. That's not easy to do. And you sort of, you juggle that first person, second person, even third person tremendously well, Chip. Talk to me about that.
I don't think I could have gotten in their heads if I hadn't been a reporter before I became an author. And I say that because, you know, one thing you learn about being a reporter is the best story is the one that you never set out to tell.
So,
and you only learn by networking. You know, you interview one person. Well, who knows more? Okay, who knows a different side to this? And that's what I did. And I interviewed police officers, prosecutors, bystanders, eyewitnesses to much. I don't think I realized how incredibly long-lasting and terrible this incident was until I knocked on the door of folks. And I had, you know, multiple people crying on me as I tried to gently ask them, well, how did this happen? Or why did this go down? Or why didn't you tell this out? You know, and literally Richard's wife, God bless her, you know, was weeping as I was asking her a question she was struggling to answer. And it was just so painful. So I, nonetheless, you know, just by walking around, knocking on doors with my notepad and pen, which I used to think were the most two powerful things in the world, you know, that's what helped me do that. And, you know, going back through my files, asking myself where I blew the story before in terms of the narrative, generating suspense and mystery where it existed. You know, you do have to get into people's heads, and you can't do it just, I think that's how they felt, or this is how I would.
Yeah.
You have to go through and do the hard work. And I have hundreds of pages of interviews, not hundreds of pages, but I mean, tens of thousands of words from interviews I've conducted.
Right. There's a number of things which caught my attention about the book and in the dialogue and the descriptions and all the different things that make up just a classically good read. The names, not just the people's names, but the names of businesses, the names of banks, law firms or whatever. Yeah. Some are made up and some are not. Am I right in that?
All the names, the businesses are accurate.
Oh, they are. Okay.
I only changed a few names. I mean, it is a reflection of how sensitive people still are, with many of the criminals still dead. So I did that because they wouldn't speak to me if I didn't. And, you know, I don't want to make them feel afraid otherwise. So, you know, it's all true, except for I changed a few names. There is one name of a company I changed. That was the name of the company where Howard worked as a freelancer before he was recommended for Space Matters.
So right.
The company, and I think I make it perfectly clear in my descriptions. Somebody could figure out exactly
the
company I'm talking about.
Right. So Space Matters, what an incredible name.
I know.
But it sounds like it's made up. It sounds like it came out of Chip's brain, but it's real.
It was. I mean, it was such an excellent name because they were called space planners back then.
Yes.
Actually, I wanted a competing name for the title for the book was Space Matters, but it seemed too vague. But it's a perfect double entendre.
Yes.
It says what they do and it says why they do it. Space matters and space does matter. So, you know, and then in the end, Jerry needed space mattering between him and these people trying to, you know, abduct his child, kill him, and maybe go after others. So, you know, you could not come up with a better, more classic 70s name of a company. And no wonder they did so well.
Yeah. You know, I went to art school, so I love graphic. I became a graphic designer, then an art director. But in my early years, I had this longing to be a space planner or an interior designer. But one of the things that stopped me from doing that was I'm terrible at math. I have dyslexia of whatever it's called when you can't add up. I can't add up, and I admit to it. So I went off and became a graphic designer, which still requires math. But what I like about your book is the details that you give us about Space Matters office and then the other different anecdotes about the interior design business. You give us it's almost like you've been working in that business. And I was curious to know, Chip, how much research you had to do for that, how much you knew prior to writing the book, because you really do get into it.
My family was involved in real estate. I was not the black sheep of the family, but I was the literary goat of the family. Even went off and grazed my own pastures. Yeah. So I did have somewhat of familiarity. I did work very ineptly in college and journalism school, you know, for my dad's company doing carpentry and things like that. And actually I ran across people like Howard. And when I tried to imagine how his face looked or did things, you know, I remembered a carpenter that befriended me that would laugh when I would screw in a socket the wrong, you get shocked and fall backwards. So I had a basic familiarity. I spent a long time with Jerry asking him what it was like, you know, seeing how his mind worked, because even though he might not have been able to get an A in calculus, the guy had a natural ability for geometry. You know, I was terrible at geometry. I loved algebra, terrible at geometry, but I did ask him more about that and how, you know, I don't want to get into, you know, doing multiplications and what's, you know, yeah, pi r squared, that type of thing.
Yes.
But, you know, I wanted to ask him, what are the elements that you tried to enhance on a floor plan inside a big commercial building? You know, light, efficiency, innovation, creating a good workplace flow, those types of things, you know. And in the 70s, these ideas of blending architecture and industrial psychology were fusing. So it was actually an exciting time. You know, it was the human growth moment and all those things.
Yes.
That all was swirling in the 70s.
You paint the details so well. It's very, it doesn't sound made up. And it isn't, as you say, but it is in some respects in the dialogue. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Chip Jacobs. His book is called The Darkest Glare, a true story of murder, blackmail, and real estate greed in 1979 Los Angeles. You know, as you and I are talking here on Zoom, every so often I'm smiling a lot. We're both smiling. We're kind of like laughing and smiling. But Chip, this is a dark, dark story, and their parts of it are gruesome, just horrible. And there are parts that are incredibly funny. I mean, it's almost slapstick in its farcical sense. Talk to me about the darkness and the comedic parts.
Sure. You know, when one of the shows that we're watching during the pandemic is Below Deck. You know, series based out of Florida and the Caribbean elsewhere, you know, and people just jump in the ocean, you know, and because it's fun, you go off a slide or a jet ski or windsurf, you know, but when you're in the ocean, and I say this as a scuba diver, you know, you are in unknown territory where you are not the apex predator. You are a visitor. You never know what is around the next coral reef. And I feel like that's what happened with Jerry and Richard. You know, they were bathing in and swimming in a beautiful freshwater lake, and then they decided to go into the ocean.
Yeah.
And when you go into the ocean, you know, creatures that you don't expect with big teeth can come after you. And so they invited that. They made that change, and all of a sudden, you know, these white collar, college educated, art school, you know, graduates were dealing with as I call them, two-legged reptiles coming from the eastern part of Los Angeles. And one of the things I really attracted me about the story and why I've continued on it, it is Los Angeles. It's three different parts, people from three different parts intersecting and clashing and colliding. And we wonder who is going to walk away from that, terrible car accident, you know, I'm saying this after Tiger
Woods.
Yeah. And so, you know, that, you know, they invited in a way this darkness in. Nobody wanted, you know, murderers coming after them. But, you know, if they wouldn't have gone into construction, if they wouldn't have, you know, sought almost a quick way to riches, they never would have dealt with this. So it is a morality story about avarice and about ambition outpacing your judgment. There's a lot of darkness in it. And, you know, to this day, there's people who were involved in this story that still don't like to look out a open window at night.
I can imagine that. Yes. You know, you just talked about the different parts of Los Angeles. I think I know Los Angeles fairly well,
yeah.
But you grew up in Pasadena and Pasadena has a very, very specific feel, and just the ambience is different to, yes, to downtown. I mean, each area, for people that aren't familiar with Los Angeles, yes, it's spread out. Yes, it's a big, but I always liken it to little villages clustered together, connected by freeways.
Yes.
you know, and you know, Eagle Rock is over there, and you've got downtown over there, and the beach is over there, and yet they're, in a lot of respects, they're very different, but there's a certain kind of ambience that the each area has, and you describe that so incredibly well in your book. This again comes back to this thing, this observational thing that you have, that you've got, that you've put to the fore in this book, and I certainly congratulate you on that, Chip. It's done very, very well.
Yes, well, thank you. Yes, I mean, Los Angeles, I mean, you know, you're LA. It is like an archipelago in search of like a common flag. And the criminals came from a lot of the criminals came from a town across the LA County line called Ontario.
Ontario, yeah, yeah.
Richard came from Beverly Hills, Bel Air, Brentwood. They call it the Platinum Triangle. Jerry came from a throwaway area in North Hollywood. A million miles away from red carpet Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it, and the car made it all possible for them to, you know, sit in the same room, you know, to try to sell space plans and construction jobs. And I found that terrifying. You know, freeways, you know, freeways are very democratic, you know, because they're not judging you by class, race, political views or whatever, but they're also really dangerous. And in fact, I just wrote an essay for the book, you know, looking at how serial killers, which were at a, you know, it was a high area for serial killers, how they use the freeways and the anonymity of taillights to do their dirty deeds. You know, in this story, Howard's El Camino was his chariot to for terrorism, you know, personal terrorism.
Yes.
And, you know, LA is it is like that. It's almost like New York, but far more spread out. People can't get, you know, I don't know if people could get away with in New York what they can in LA, because, you know, what does a police force in a little town 70 miles from Los Angeles know about what's going on, you know, in the urban part of the city? Not very much.
I was curious to know, when you started writing the book and you're collating this information, you're doing the interviews with people, and you know where you're going with it. But I'm wondering, did it ever get daunting to you about just getting to the point where you had to sort of wrap it up? You've got to, like, okay, tie a knot on it and tie a bow and say, okay, it's done now. The editing process for you, because you've got a lot of information in there. I'm just wondering about how much you needed to put in, as opposed to how much you wanted to put in, but you couldn't get in because of maybe time or...
Sure. I, you know what, I wrote my first novel that came out in 2019. Ironically, I've had two books now, you know, one at the tail end of the beginning of the pandemic, the other at the end. So that's how long this thing has gone on. I did not feel that pressure on this book. I felt it on my novel because it was about my hometown of Pasadena. It was a historical novel and you have to get it right. I felt that same pressure when I was writing the story, co-writing the story, the LA smog crisis through the years, because this is, you know, this was well-known recorded, you know, events. This story was more personal. I felt like when I wrote it this time, I understood the universe and I understood how much to turn up the different buttons, like an engineer at a recording studio, you know, to make it work, you know. And I wanted, you know, you never want, if you have a side character, you never want to go four or five paragraphs. Just one.
Right. Yes.
Paul Feigen is a super interesting guy, you know, but he only works in service to the narrative of the main characters.
Right.
I didn't feel daunted. I felt when I was going around interviewing people and seeing their faces collapse and them getting, you know, heaving in tears and regrets. That's what bothered me as a very sensitive person who's known to cry over a sappy commercial. That's, you know, who am I to go dig up a ghost? I still struggle with that. I feel like I got everything in there that needed to get in there. I did expand from my previous writings about this on the courts, you know, and the trial, about what Howard was doing between the time, you know, the first murder and maybe many, many more, you know. And he was just going around Los Angeles like nothing was wrong. He was just, you know, eating his lunch and hammering a nail and supervising a job. And, you know, ironically, one of the jobs that he was working on between the time, you know, before he was caught was for the California Association of Realtors. So think about that. That is a well-known trade group. He is redesigning the offices, you know, of a group that represents his industry, you know, well, he's washed blood off his car.
Howard is a despicable character, yet I'm not going to say there's anything sort of lovable about him, but at some point, in some points in your book, I'm kind of, I almost feel a little bit of, not empathy, I'm trying to think of, choose the right word. Sorry? No, not sorry. Sympathy? I felt a little something for him because you paint him as being this diabolical figure, yet at the same time, he's got flaws like the rest of us outside of being diabolical. He's a human being.
Of course. That's really a good point. I mean, criminals don't wake up in the morning and go, I'm a snake of a person.
Yeah.
They know how to justify their actions. You know, Howard, at some point, I think he saw life passing him by, and those people around him that maybe he looked down on before he was a monster, they were doing much better than he was, like Louis Buonsanti, this Argentinian. Yes. He moved to the LA area, and he befriended and helped, gave work to, and then all of a sudden he is flourishing more than Howard.
Yeah.
Richard and Jerry, you know, although that's more complicated. I think something snapped in him, you know, and maybe I believe he had killed before, but something snapped in him sometime in the 70s that said, you know what? I had the right to get what was mine because LA is a very ruthless place. Why should I play by the rules when everybody is exploiting blue collars? It's very much a blue collar, white collar rivalry, I think, going on in his mind. You know, I have the most sympathy for Richard, actually, because Richard was bipolar. They called it manic depressive back in the day. I'm not absolving him of his own sins and his own culpability and his own willingness to stick around LA when, you know, predators were skulking towards him. But, you know, mental illness played a very obvious role in the mind.
Yes.
I'm sure Howard had, sociopathy, psychopathy. I don't know. I'm not a therapist, but he, him as well. But Howard's disease was resentment. It was a brooding self-loathing in himself that he should have been doing better. Yet look at all these others making millions in real estate. He'd been doing it for 20 years.
Yes.
And now he's got bill collectors at his door, a bad back, a nervous wife. Meanwhile, other people are driving Mercedes.
You want to almost think of him as a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde character, but he's not. He's much more complex than that. And that's, I love the way you've painted him. Something else I like about your book is the female characters. Now, the reason I mention this is that often in a story like this, unless they are the protagonist or the number two character, they're kind of sort of almost two-dimensional. But you tell us a lot about the female characters and you paint them, particularly some of the minor characters. I'm trying to think of the one that was having an affair with Richard that worked at the office. And gosh, I can't think of her name right now without looking it up. But
you're thinking of Bree.
Bree, yes.
Yes. Well, actually, Bree, I'll just tell you, Bree has passed on, sadly. I reached out to her. She was like a skittish cult about what I called. She didn't want, she loved Richard. I think she was still in love with Richard even after he dumped her and married somebody else in a rather cruel way. It took me a long time for her to trust me and to open up to me. And when she did, I was so thankful I met her once. You know, I didn't want to paint her as, brown hair and short.
Yeah. Yes.
She liked, she liked wearing clogs or some basic thing. So, I know these people. And so I did try to present them well. I also wanted to show that female intuition is not just, a link on the internet. It's a true thing. And if the men had listened to the women who weren't maybe so tactically minded and sales oriented, they would probably have been alive. They all saw Howard across the way and go, there's something not right about him.
Yes.
He doesn't talk. He's very observant. There's something about his pores that just don't feel right. And she said it made the hair on her arms go up when she saw Howard. you know, and she knew him, and they maybe shared a cup of coffee. I feel like, you know, when you get somebody who's very ambitious, the antenna God gave you when you were born, your instincts get worn down or chopped off, and women, for the most part, keep them, you know, but they can't make somebody, you know, change their stripes because they have a bad feeling in their stomach. I wish they would have. I really do.
Chip, the way that you put the story together is based on actual facts. And the dialogue, of course, you've had to improvise, you've made up, you have imagined.
Right.
How much of what Bree or what Schneiderman told you did you actually put into the book? I'm curious about that.
A lot.
A lot.
You know, I could have had a whole chapter just on Bree's life with Richard.
Right.
And, you know, he was a very damaged guy. And in some ways, you know, she helped revitalize him, restore his self-confidence after a divorce, after some professional setbacks. But I couldn't do that. So I had to, for some people like her, just distill the best of what she told me in terms of the action I've chosen to use. Jerry, you know, I knew very well because he was my golden goose source as a reporter. And I spent hours and hours and hours with him. You know, in this retelling, I cut way back on non-murder triangle elements, but I still bring him in and try to show how warped he was in the years afterwards. Some people didn't like that. In fact, I have some people saying, well, is this really a true crime story? Because you have so much about him afterwards. And it's like, yes, that's what makes the story different. I don't want to write a true crime story. I want to write a human story. And so lots of what Jerry told me is in there. I didn't fill the book with his quotes and commentary and, you know, reactions to things because that fell out of the flow of the story. I really always want to keep the action driving ahead. He did tell me a lot, like especially about the graveyard scene. So in my book, after Jerry's partner is killed, his lawyer calls him out to Westwood, you know, on the west side of LA, says, let's take a walk. And they're walking through a celebrity filled graveyard, a little postage stamp size place behind a big office tower, you know, and I did say, can you just take me through what was said? Can you tell me And then I would write something up and send it to him, say, does this feel accurate? And he generally said, yes, you know. He's also remembering something that happened decades back. So, you know, where it came to key dialogue with Jerry, I did try to, you know, work with him closely to get it right.
When you first met Jerry, and you met him on a number of occasions, right?
Oh, yeah.
What was your first impression?
Jerry was a different breed of activist. You know, when you're a reporter, you're dealing with all types of sources, all types of activists. Jerry wasn't like any of them. Jerry had money. He had a Rolls Royce. He could have afforded a nice office, but he lived in his place was in a dumpy building at Hollywood and Vine when I first met him. He was very articulate. He wasn't manic like some activists are. You know, he was very well organized, and he was just like a present dropped from heaven as a reporter. And he just seemed to have like an intelligence network of people saying, hey, what about this going on in City Hall? Or what about this corruption happening over there? And, you know, it took me years before he opened up to me. And I do replay that part in the book. I mean, like 2 or 3 years and many front page stories later, he goes, oh, by the way, did you know I had a double murderer chasing me? And this was happening during the Clinton impeachment hearing. So I've gone from one impeachment to the next over the years. And when somebody says that, you do a double take. And it's like, I just thought he was BSing, trying to inflate his importance, looking cool. And we got into a game where he would tell me one more bizarre thing after another. And I would go down to the Hall of Records in downtown LA and find out it was true. So, you know, we met many times. We collaborated. You know, this isn't this is his story, but it's not his bigger universe, you know, so I had to walk that line.
I'm glad you told me that because I wondered about how much that you wanted this to be, because it doesn't come across like the Jerry Schneiderman story, but you do tell us an awful lot. For my listeners that have just joined us, the book is called The Darkest Glare, a true story of murder, blackmail, and real estate greed in 1979 Los Angeles. And my guest is the author, Chip Jacobs. Were there surprises along the way, as you're talking to Jerry in particular, maybe to Brie or anybody else, any other people that you spoke to, were there things that popped up that you were like, that took you by surprise?
I would say the number one surprise has nothing to do with Jerry. It has to do with the first hitman that Howard recruited to launch his Murder for Profit Corporation. Just think about that. You know, yes. A contractor that's resentful, angry, cagey, three-step ahead thinker. He recruits lowlives to go do his base, you know. But the first one he did, he thought he had great mastery over. Bails him out of jail and lets him use his car, gives him some money, a gas card. Here's some employment for you. But he kind of is, he grooms him. He doesn't tell him initially, what I want you to do is go shoot another human being, preferably right. Head. And this hitman eventually, you know, looks at his life and realizes, you know, I carried out all the things Howard wanted me to do. I will have racked up a casualty count more than the Manson family killers.
Yes.
He did not want to do that. I'm so glad you asked me that, because I wish a reviewer would pick up on this. This man, even though by trying to disrupt the assassination, you know, he's doing it to try to lessen his own
right.
involvement and get a better, you know, deal on other crimes he's committed. He showed great moral courage. And it was shocking that of all these learned people, some with law degrees and judges, of all that cast, it was a guy who was a junkie, bisexual, ex-convict with a checkered past. He was the one that actually was the hero.
And mentioned that there's a scene where Howard goes to one of they're in a room or a bedroom at somebody's house, one of the other characters, yeah. And they're all doing drugs. They're doing heroin, yeah. They're doing cocaine. It's and Howard is getting really into it. And the supposed assassin starts to think about what he's doing and questions his own.
Yes.
I love that scene. You paint that scene so incredibly well.
Yeah, thank you. The man's name is Robert Freeman. His nickname was Frenchie. I've never spoken to him. Everything I learned, I did through prosecutors, court documents, etc. Yeah, and I think at that moment he realized, you know, he was in a den of vipers, and eventually he was going to get bitten. And so he came up with this idea of trying to get his best friend, yes. who ended up being the trigger man, to become the lead assassin while he got out of town and moved to Haight-Ashbury to be yeah. with his wife, you know, one of his wives, who knows.
One of his wives. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very chancy decision and probably saved his life, but Howard would not let it go. And Howard went and terrorized the guy's mom. He tried to pull over his stepbrother to say, would you be willing for some money to kill everybody here? Howard became obsessed, like Trump was obsessed with overturning the election. Howard was obsessed with silencing this hitman that ran away from him, said, I don't want to do it. Didn't say it in those terms. Howard would not let it go. He was like a cobra that had, you know, a mouse in a hole that he's not going to let escape through some labyrinth, element to it. You know, it was really creepy.
The assassin part of the story, or the attempted assassins, is, as we said, the story is very dark, some very dark moments, but there's also as comedic moments that are not meant to be comedic, but they are comedic in that they can't carry out the hit. That's true stuff, right?
Yes. I mean, it was the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Yeah.
And I don't want to make fun of a deadly encounter.
Right.
Multiple deadly encounters, but they had bad luck, poor timing, a ill-thought out plan to draw somebody out of their house to shoot them. And, you know, eventually you would think they were almost like neighbors, you know, around the first target's house, because they went back so many times to take him out. Even on the night they finally succeeded, the guy wasn't home, you know, and they have to go to a diner and have some food and pray maybe things will be better when they come back. And sure enough, the trigger man is driving Howard's El Camino, and the car was there, and they lit up like Santa Claus, you know, had come down the chimney. Then you add on all the bizarre things that happened to Jerry. After the murder is carried out, he gets in his car to try to go take his family someplace safe, and the car starts smoking, and they think there's a bomb in the car under the car. And all that is true. And, you know, I mean, real life is more traumatizing and more unpredictable than anything and not the best novels could come up.
Right.
That's why I really love this story.
Can you just, for my listeners, can you just give a brief overview of the sawn-off shotgun scene? Because that is just, I mean, it's so bizarre.
Yes. So before Robert Freeman decided he didn't want to be Howard's, you know, killer, Howard was a big believer in creating alibis. And really, he was a very strategic thinker and thought out, okay, how, you know, we're going to be in Las Vegas when this happens and our name will be on the registry. And, you know, the person I'm asking to carry off this heinous deed has got a long record and who are they going to believe, you know? And so Howard gives Robert a shotgun for accuracy and power. He wanted him to saw off the muzzle. And so Robert takes us out in Idaho, Ontario, feeling very ambivalent and nervous about the whole thing. He's sawing off the shotgun and he did something that caused it to discharge a bullet out of it. Of course, the thing was loaded and it exploded and a little metal sliver from the barrel propelled into his eyeball. And can you imagine? I mean, your eyes are the most sensitive part of you, generally speaking. And a terrific blinding white light pain that he got, you know, and all of a sudden here he is with a, you know, bleeding puffy eye, may go blind, right? A shotgun that's now lying on the ground. Everybody in the neighborhood has heard this boom and he's got a very angry, determined boss that expects a killing done while he's in Vegas, you know, to have to, you know, talk down from shooting him again. And I think that was the inflection point for Robert to realize, you know what, this is not for me. That really very much took him from being a bad person to being a valiant one that was trying to spare his target's life. So yeah, I mean, he's lucky he didn't go blind, but in a way that metal sliver woke him up.
He's now dead, yes.
I don't know. And I almost don't want to know. He's a really interesting protagonist. And, you know, his efforts to get his lawyer to go to somebody to stop this, you know, were really dramatic. And I kind of struggled how to tell that because I wanted to leave a cliffhanger for the court scene. And so I kept it there. But as much as Jerry got Howard apprehended, Robert Freeman did as well, because without his inside testimony, who knows what would have happened.
How did the LAPD and any of the officialdom help you? Were they helpful?
Well, I could not get the official murder report because that's generally off limits to reporters. You know, I did get I got the autopsy report. I interviewed two of the detectives and they were great. But, you know, detectives are working so many jobs over so many years. It's like a newspaper reporter. One story blurs into the next.
Yes.
The best thing I could do is get the testimony, you know, from court records and then, you know, read them, understand them, write up questions, then ask them, you know, in person, you know, what they thought or they could expand. And they did to some degree. One of the really disturbing elements I found is when you go to the Hall of Records, they get courts. You know, there is nobody watching who takes what. The file on this case, on this trial of Howard Garrett, probably had only like a third of the documents left. I don't know if ambitious movie producers who were interested in this story from the very beginning went and took them. I don't know if people trying to exculpate themselves, you know, swiped them. I don't know, but it was really upsetting. And I worked on an investigative story for the LA Times where I found the same thing. It's really, you shouldn't be able to walk out with official records,
right?
You know, because that now you're stealing history. Yes, the LAPD was helpful just in terms of talking to detectives, but they weren't releasing gobs of information. And in the end, I didn't really need it because I had the court records.
Chip, I've got to ask you. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this. Are you optioning this as a made for TV series or a movie? Is that in the pipeline?
I've had a lot of interest in this over the years. Thank you for asking. I have an agent who was fantastic. He's one of the legends in the business. And, you know, he's handling all those things. But yes, I am getting some interest.
So a younger Harvey Keitel would be my choice for Howard.
I have some others. I, okay. I'll tell you, I know who I want to play Jerry.
Yes.
He was the star of Social Network and an excellent actor, Jesse Eisenberg.
Yes. Oh,
looks
yes.
Like Jerry, he's got yes. incredible range. You know, Jerry was hard to understand. To some people, he seemed like this miserly, you yes. know, hand-rubbing, money-oriented mystery. To others, he was this nerdy hero.
Nerdy, yes. So, yes.
And just like Richard, and some people, the women especially thought Richard was this hunky, charismatic Prince Charming, and others thought he was a feather-haired snake. You yes. know, so it's. There's some really interesting people that I would love to play. You know, I think Bryan Cranston. He would not be a terrible Howard.
No, it's funny you said that because I was thinking to myself, Bryan Cranston would be an obvious choice. Yet. I feel like he's been in too many things recently. So
he's great in everything. If I had my pick, of course, you know, who am I to say anything? Paige, Richard's, you know,
yes.
beautiful, you know, yes. wife. And, you know, I have to say, this woman was unbelievable. I mean, she's a young woman, far younger than Richard. And all of a sudden, you know, she has a man creeping up the stairway of her house, trying to abduct her baby, gets a phone call saying, your husband's a dead man, tell him to go around making nice. It happens. She knows, suspects who it is. And, you know, she's like abandoned to the wolves. And I, that she survived this and thrived is a remarkable testimony.
I am so glad you mentioned Paige because I made a note. And there's one, yeah. when we talked about women, the females, I really wanted to focus. Thank you so much for mentioning that.
I would say, you know, who would be great actresses for Paige if
yes.
I had to pick
yeah.
would be Brie Larson.
Ah.
Or Blake Lively. Yeah. I mean, I actually think it would be a fantastic role for some characters.
Oh, yeah.
And then also I have a former Israeli mercenary. You know, who was going to play Ari? Ari was this bizarre character.
You
would think a screenwriter just said, you know what, we need to get some dude from the Middle East in this story. This was one of Jerry's believers and friends and his muscle.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and Ari did not like how long the LAPD was taking to round up the killers. And he really was champing at the bit to let Jerry say, let me have him. And Jerry did have this morality, even though he wanted to make money and was assertive in his nerdy way. He had a morality that neither of the other two partners did, you know? So, I don't know about the full cast, but
I know that's okay.
It could be, it's such an interesting story. Even the relationship between Jerry and his mother, Jerry, I'll just tell you, came from a very strange childhood where his mother had some form of depression and anxiety, often that would leave her in bed. And Jerry had to be an adult, you know, before he could shave, helping out around the house, picking out her clothes, fixing her coffee. And, you know, Jerry wanted to get out of that house. He wanted to see the world. He felt very confined. His mother also believed, you know, was kind of a germaphobe. And, you know, Jerry wanted to get out in the world. He goes, gets a degree from Art Center of Los Angeles, very well-renowned place. And then he's, you know, exploited by his corporate masters, starts a new business with Richard, who he thought he needed because he looked so darn young. And
yeah.
Richard was older and more experienced and had all that, you know, smoothness he lacked.
Yes.
And, his relationship with his mom over the years. And even during this, when his mom would go, Jerry, what did you do? You must have brought this guy into your life. You can tell your mother. You can tell me. She was his perfect boy. And after a while, I think Jerry wanted to wrap that phone cord in his hideout hotel around his neck to go, Mom, stop it. So
yeah.
Can you, just a little bit of more pressure on Jerry having his mom saying, you know what, there's somehow in this, you have a culpability.
You know, at the very beginning, I said there is so much that we can talk about with this book. And we've covered an awful lot, but there's so much more. It really is. It's a thrilling read. It's a terrifically well written. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And if you do get it onto the screen, I want to talk to you about that.
I'm not taking anything for granted. You know, it's
right.
It's not easy being an author. I mean, you're speaking of the ocean. I mean, you're like a fish swimming.
Yeah.
You know, in an estuary where there's hundreds of new species being introduced all the time. I still believe in the story. I still believe in the heart of the people that survived, you know, or moved on to the next plane of existence, you know, and I just want them to know they can beat the monsters. You know, they're not as scary as their own fear. So I really feel strongly about that. And I want Richard's children, Cherry's children, to know the best of them, to know that when they think about them, they're seeing them haloed. Good.
Well done. I like that. My guest has been Chip Jacobs. The book, The Darkest Glare, a true story of murder, blackmail, and real estate greed in 1979 Los Angeles. Terrific book, Chip. Really enjoyed reading it and really enjoyed talking with you. You're a great guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is one of my favorite places. So, you know, if I'm knocking on your door, you know, just leave me a chair. Just spray it.
You got it, my friend. Anytime. You want to come back on? Anytime. I really appreciate it.
You and your listeners, stay safe.
Thank you very much, Chip. All the best to you.
A very large thank you to Chip Jacobs, and a big, big thank you to you for listening. All the links to the books and music we feature on Life Elsewhere can be found over at lifeelsewhere.co. And you've got a lot of choices to hear this show again. NPR One, Apple Podcasts, the various stations we're on. Again, everything's listed over at lifeelsewhere.co. Now, your feedback is important. I read all your emails, so send me your thoughts. My email address comes up in just a moment in the closing credits, so be ready to jot it down. Till next time, be well, be safe, and always, you know, it costs absolutely nothing. Be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.